This was such a great podcast. I loved it. It was fun, lots of information. I learned so much. Now I can impress my friends when we go out for cocktails face to face again. Thanks. Look forward to the next episode. Take care.
Hey folks, before we begin, just a quick heads up that during the interview portion of this episode, we briefly mentioned domestic abuse and alcohol abuse, and some listeners may be sensitive to these subjects. Hey folks, welcome back on this blustery winter's day. I am your host, Alexa Wilkinson.
And I'm your co-host, Mia Fiorito.
And this is
Drink History.
Going to go all the way back to a time of speakeasies, homebrewing, political upheaval, and discrimination. And no, I am not talking about 2020. Today, we are going to cover Prohibition and its invisible legacy. And joining us later on the episode is author of Dry Manhattan, Prohibition in New York City, and professor Michael Lerner. And while we do that, we're going to drink a French 75 because yum. And also because it's a classic Prohibition era cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mia.
Yes.
This is a delicious cocktail, the French 75.
It is. It is.
Fun fact, did you know, one of the only two cocktails ordered in all of the movie Casablanca.
Really?
Yeah. And I have a clip to play from Casablanca of when Yvonne, the scorned lover of Rick, orders the French 75. Let's play this clip right here.
Yvonne's going over to the enemy.
Who knows? In her own way, she may constitute an entire second front. Well, I think it's time for me to flatter Major Strasser a little. I'll see you later, Rick.
Sasha!
French 75.
Put up a whole row of those, Sasha. Starting here and ending here.
We will begin with two.
Vous êtes français, vous d'aller avec les Boches comme ça?
Quand vous mêlez-vous?
Je me mêle pas français, moi.
Pas de français.
No. 1 minute.
So then they get into it like a fight. But that's one of my favorite movies, and I sort of
starting here and ending here.
Ending here. She wants rows of them. She wants rows of French 75s.
What a ballin' ass woman.
I know. She really had a lot of audacity. Anyway, so yes. Mia, we're going to talk about Prohibition a little bit, and then we'll get into the French 75. So the reason we wanted to talk about Prohibition's legacy is because it really has shaped a lot of the drinking laws and the taxation and the way we buy and sell liquor. And I think that it's so far removed from our initial education of Prohibition. Like, mm-hmm. We talked about this the other day. I can't remember being taught in school about Prohibition. Can you? Like, barely?
Barely. It was more so the things that stick in my head were like, oh, no one was allowed to drink. There was a bunch of flappers running around. And
just running all over,
just like doing their thing,
marathons of flappers.
Get out of my way! I'm a flapper, and I'm on a marathon, I'm running around. Yeah, that's pretty much it, though. It was like that, like the Charleston.
Yeah, they were just running around doing the Charleston, and that's all we knew about it. Yeah. So this cocktail made sense to do in a way because when I think of like the fancy, you know, the Great Gatsby level of Prohibition and the time of like the, you know, the golden age of drinking really was when it was so illegal that it was lawless. Mm-hmm. It was like I imagine Prohibition in this fancy, upscale, classy way of like just champagne flowing everywhere and right. Just people getting drunk in speakeasies and playing jazz. But there really is this invisible legacy of Prohibition that's actually rooted in a lot of nativism, segregation, anti-immigrant messaging, just in general, like attacking poor and working class people. And that is the saddest part of it to me. But at the same time, we still do have these cocktails that sort of came out of the Prohibition era or around the time that we consider classic, and we still like they're staples on drink menus.
Yeah.
But I had never, like the Sazerac before, I had never had a French 75. I've had plenty of champagne cocktails, but I don't think I've ever had one that specifically was the French 75 until we made it.
I have definitely made a bunch of renditions, like a lavender French, you know, and stuff like that, where you kind of like tweak something about like the originality of it, like just the citrus. It has to always have some other element. But I actually had my first French 75 probably like right before the shutdown. I went over to Mama Rue here in Newburgh, New York, and they have a killer French 75.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was really good. And I love like the little coupe glass that it comes in. Yeah. Like that old school. It was really good. I think that's the first time that I actually was like, yeah, I'll try it, because a friend of mine ordered it. And I was like, oh, you know what? Fuck it. I'll try it. And it was really good. I thought it was really great. I loved like the citrus, like whole citrus element of it. It's not too sweet. It's nice and tart for me.
Yeah.
Granted, it does have that simple syrup, so.
Well, you need the sugar to balance that a little bit. You can't have, you got to have the, it is a beautifully balanced cocktail. I'll give it that. So it's very good. For today's cocktail, we are using Great Nine Gin from Denning's Distillery, which is just across the street from moi. See
Great
what I
distillery.
Did there? Put in a little French.
From moi.
Yeah,
that's a great distillery, though. They do have really good stuff there.
They really do. Their vodkas are great, too.
The Maid of the Meadow. Oof.
Yeah, it's so good. I just drink that by itself with the little Cuba
on
ice.
A rock.
So good.
Yeah.
We're also using Tattinger's champagne and a lemon simple syrup I made last night just to give it a little extra lemony zest to it. It's nice. And then just fresh lemon juice. And that's it. It's really And just lemon juice. So simple.
Yeah.
You shake all the non-fuzzy stuff up. Fuzzy. You shake all the non-bubbly things together. Fuzzy.
Oh, I love that. It makes me feel warm.
The non-fuzzies. And then you put in the fuzzy. Oh,
and then you're nice
so
and warm.
And then you're nice and warm. So, Mia, I want to learn. I saved the educational part of the French 75 for you telling me about it. So I haven't like read ahead. I haven't. You sent me over the research that you've done, but I didn't even read it because I want to experience it in real time.
Right.
Like the way the audience is going to experience this knowledge that you're going to just
the
drop
nail
on
biting.
Us.
Okay.
You're going to pour into our glass this beautiful little goblet of knowledge. So. Tell us about the French 75, but before we do that, take us back to a time. Yes, the French 75.
Such a classic. I love this. It's very like setting the mood. It kind of sounds like a mystery.
It's a mystery. Let's solve this mystery together. Let's the mystery of the French 75.
I have all the clues.
So I will fade it out. Okay, French 75, Mia, go, tell me.
So I really, really love the backstory for the French 75. But I want to, before we get into like the actual name about it, like how it got its name, I wanted to talk about where it allegedly was created and by who. So there was this place called Harry's New York Bar. It was originally called New York Bar. It was created in 1911 in Paris, France, by a jockey named by an American jockey named Todd Sloan. And Todd Sloan really, really wanted to open up a bar that had like the aesthetic and the feel of a New York bar. So what he did was that he took a bar that he already had owned in New York City, decided like, you know, what's a better way? What's a better way than
was he English or American?
No, he was American. So I'll just talk normal. What's a better way that like to have a New York bar in Paris than to bring a New York bar to Paris? So he took the bar that he owned and took like dismantled it from head to toe. Then he had it shipped over to Paris, and then in another building that he had bought, had that New York bar rebuilt the same exact way as the previous bar in New York. So it literally a New York bar in Paris. I thought that was so cool.
So, like, if he had the option of just, like, lifting the building up and, like, flying it to Paris, he probably would have done it.
So another, like, super American thing that he did was that he ended up actually opening the bar on Thanksgiving Day, which I also thought was, like, a cute little, okay, all right, Todd, I see you. Being real, like, whatever. So after opening the bar, Sloan hired this guy from Scotland. His name was Harry McElhone. I think that's how you say his last name. McElhone. I don't know if you pronounce it differently, but...
Yeah, that seems right.
I think it seems right. So McElhone. Yeah, there you go. Harry McElhone.
Harry McElhone.
From Scotland. So he hired Harry to help run New York Bar, which ended in Harry actually like buying the bar from Sloan 12 years later in 1923. And what I love about what Harry did, he was like, oh, you know, I guess I'm going to own the bar. I can't do accents, Alexa, I can't. But he ended up just like saying, okay, well, I bought this bar from Todd. It's my bar now. So I'm just gonna slap my name on it. So now it's Harry's New York Bar. And it's famous as Harry's New York Bar. Because, I mean, like, 12 years of the bar being established afterwards, like, from that 12-year point now until now, it's a pretty big deal that it's known as Harry's New York Bar.
Okay.
Is
it still there, do you know?
No, it is. Yeah, it's still there. I had the address. It was like five Denaru or Rue Denau, something like that. I can look it up, or, you know, we can look it up right when we finish this. But yeah, it's still there and it's still the exact same way. So cool thing about Harry is that Harry ended up being a huge defining figure in bartending while he was bartending at the New York Bar, or at New York Bar, not the New York Bar. He ended up being someone who is credited for many famous Prohibition cocktails, such as the Sidecar, the Monkey Gland, the White Lady, the earliest form of the French 75. And he actually apparently also invented the Bloody Mary, which I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Okay. The Bloody Mary. I love Bloody Marys. Bloody Marys. Yeah. With a lot of Tabasco. Make that spicy.
I know. I love it. I love it with a lot of Worcestershire for some reason.
Oh, I'm like the Tabasco girl. Give me all the Tabasco.
I like a lot of horseradish, a lot of Worcestershire. I just love Bloody Marys. Everyone has their own taste preference too.
Mm-hmm. I could go for a Bloody Mary personal right drink. Now.
Yeah, same.
Alexa Maybe and after. I, not, yeah, not to go off topic, but we had a bunch of French 75s last night. And you know how, like, in the morning the next day you want something like a Bloody Mary? I feel like the hangover is so real that I should be drinking a Bloody Mary right now and not another French 75.
Well, you know what? You're a trooper for the sake of, you know, our audience. Yeah.
Cheers to you, my friend.
The consistency. Cheers to you. We gotta keep it, you know, on brand.
Mm-hmm. And so the French 75, the name of it, which is so funny because you and I felt like shit the next day, a.k.a. today.
A.k.a. now.
A.k.a. right now. The inspiration of the title was actually after a 75-millimeter howitzer field gun used by the French and the Americans in World War One. So the gun was known for its accuracy and speed, and the French 75 is said to have such a kick that it felt like being hit by such a weapon. And I will attest to that because,
yeah,
I definitely went to war last night.
You're welcome. We drank a bunch of them so you wouldn't have to test the theory.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome.
We made it out alive, but, you know.
Absolutely causes hangovers.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have that many.
Yeah, we only had two.
Yeah.
So back to Harry.
Yeah.
He is known as the man, and that bar is known as a place that had been where the French 75 had come about. But
so that's like the origin story is Harry's New York Bar.
Yeah, by
in
Harry.
In Paris.
Mm-hmm.
came out of World War One,
right? Named after this gun.
Yeah. Okay.
That they used in World War One, but Charles Dickens, back in the roaring 1860s, was reported to have entertained his guests with Tom gin and champagne cups. And a champagne cup is pretty much bubbly sugar, citrus, and ice. And I mean, that's pretty much a French 75 if you know it. If someone was like, oh, let's put champagne and some sugar, some citrus and ice, and let's just, I mean, it doesn't have like the gin per se, yeah, but like in that champagne cup. But like if someone's like, throw some gin in it, then yeah, it definitely is like it's a French 75. And yeah, that was full, like two full decades before the howitzer gun was even invented. So,
okay,
I feel like it definitely was dancing around in history as like a thing, but until that gun was made and someone was like, hot damn, this drink makes me feel like I was just shot by a 75 millimeter howitzer. You know?
That's a really specific thing.
Yeah. Yes. Right? I thought that was really cool, stuck, though, being named after a gun.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's the last drink I would think would be named after, like,
armed, you know, warfare.
Yeah, warfare. It's very, it reminds me of something I'd order on, like, a brunch with my mom.
Yeah.
This is a mom brunch drink.
Delicate.
And not to knock anyone drink. I'm drinking it, and I, you know, mm-hmm, drink some pretty horrid stuff. But this is, like, this does pack a punch. It's very
it'll get dangerous. You.
It'll mm-hmm get you.
And it's so, it's not like,
you want to get your mother-in-law to admit some stuff, feed her some French 75.
Yeah, she'd be like, oh, this is so delicate and light. It's because I think that
she'd be like, I never liked you.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Okay, so with that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be interviewing author of the book Dry Manhattan, Prohibition in New York City, Michael Lerner. He's fantastic and super knowledgeable, and we're very excited to be speaking with him later. So we'll give you a little break. We'll be right back. So our guest today is the author of Dry Manhattan, Prohibition in New York City. Michael Lerner, thank you so much for being with us today to talk about Prohibition. I'm not going to ask you, I feel like the glossed over bullet points of Prohibition. There is some sort of Italian car driving around the background. I don't know if anyone heard. It's like blasting Italian music. It was actually quite pleasant. So we don't need to go through the whole, like, Prohibition was the, you know, prohibition of alcohol and the selling and distribution of liquor. But I do need to ask you, like, right off the bat, what should we know about Prohibition that we are not taught in school? Like, what are the bullet points that you can give us that, you know, because I asked Mia last night, like, do you even remember being taught about Prohibition
right
in school? I barely remember that mm-hmm that lesson. And I don't – and I – the only reason that I know more about it and became interested in it is because I became a Cicerone. I became a bartender. I became interested in the culture. I became interested in the bartending culture. I became interested in mixology. And Prohibition has such this long legacy in the cocktail culture and bartending. And it's just something we all, like, talk about and revere as this time. But it's always – talked about in such a glossy, flappery, speakeasy, making whiskey in your dad's basement kind of, like, attitude. But I feel like there's so much more to it that's a little darker and a little more political and a little rougher.
Yeah. Well, you bring up a lot of good points. I mean, I think as someone who works in a school with teenagers, I know there's always this discomfort in terms of teaching this, you know, what's the central issue here? It's alcohol. And I think people shy away from bringing anything alcohol related into, you know, a typical secondary school curriculum. So, you know, that means for a lot of students, they don't really get to this until college. And then, it just gets glossed over in sort of the general sweep of things as you study American history. And I think, even I had trouble when I was starting my project. You know, this was my dissertation originally, and then turned into the book. But you know, people would say it's not a serious topic. It's frivolous. It's, you know, it's about the Roaring Twenties and Great Gatsby type things and speakeasies and, you know, nightclubs. But there's really nothing serious there. And one of the things that I was very invested in exploring was, you know, how serious this was as both a political issue and as a social issue. I mean, this really was, people throw the term culture wars around, and we certainly see our fair share of those today. And Prohibition was a culture war. It was something that really pitted very different views of American society and morality against one another. It, you know, it was a time or a situation when people were very quick to point fingers at the other and blame them for whatever problems that they were seeing or encountering in the way Prohibition was unfolding. So it's, you know, it's something that I think I'm always cautious about, you know, overstating, oh, the lessons of Prohibition, but I think we can see it as an example of divided, you know, an America that was divided, and, you know, with real ramifications for both social and political, you know, the social and political tenor of American society.
Yeah, it totally was. I mean, I watched the documentary that you lended your face and voice and expertise to on PBS, and I was just thinking when I was watching it, how similar it sort of feels to this day and age of the political divisiveness and the spectrum that we find ourselves in. Do you see similarities to what happened back then to now? It seems a little like back then it was a little more overt. There's a lot more overt anti-immigrant behavior. I think now it's this like nicer language with a similar undertone.
Oh, I'm going to push back and say I disagree. I think we're in something, an anti-immigrant tone right now, you know, where the former president of the United States is calling Mexicans rapists, that I think, you know, easily matches the anti-immigrant tone of the 1920s. I mean, it's no mistake that part of what, you know, is all wrapped up in Prohibition. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan was a huge supporter of Prohibition. Part of what motivated the Dry Movement was this fear of an animosity towards immigrants because they wouldn't behave a certain way and they were going to change America. And so when you have people today talking about taking America back, making America great again, you know, it does to me very much echo some of the tone in Prohibition. I mean, there is a very ugly side to the Dry Movement that basically says these people aren't Americans. They don't belong here. They need to be policed. They need to be arrested. They need to be jailed. So it runs through, you know, I think there are huge parallels between the anti-immigrant tone today and what people heard in the 1920s. And it went beyond Prohibition. I mean, the anti-immigrant thing wasn't just about Prohibition, but it was certainly tied up in it.
Do you think that the ability for the political spectrum of it all, when I was watching and reading about like how temperance started, and there's a lot of women that were really against saloons and drinking because, and I gotta be honest with you, it made sense to me. Like their husbands came home drunk and beat them. There was no divorce. I can relate to this being a women on the forefront issue because they're really just thinking about their health and their safety as well as their children's.
Yeah.
But I sort of noticed that as time went on and the movement started kicking up and people started really getting into the Dry Movement was like focused on one singular issue. And that was the political machine that started to work. It was like, we can't just abolish saloons because that's, you're talking about breweries, these like multi-million dollar conglomerates, you're trying to take all them down. If you stop the alcohol, you stop them. And so these political hacks like really knew how to drive this message home. And I find nowadays it's harder to focus on one issue when we have so many issues. Do you think the lack of sort of the modern day social media presence made it a lot easier for people to singular that one message?
Well, you know, I mean, you're bringing up a lot of great points. I mean, let's just start with media. The Dry Movement was a movement that mastered the social media of their time. You know, they invested a lot in media. They were experts in advertising. They were experts in publishing. They ran their own publishing companies. They funded things very well. They were lobbyists. I mean, that's also one of the things. I mean, you know, I feel like people get a little upset when suddenly talking about, you know, you go from Great Gatsby and speakeasies and nightclubs to suddenly you're talking about political theory and you know, mass political movements. But the serious thing here is that the dry movement was really, to me, a great example of an early and very successful political lobbying movement with everything we see in today's lobbying. Lots of money, very carefully messaged politics, you know, political messages that were meant to win over voters, that were meant to intimidate opponents. They were ruthless. You know, they were relentless and very successful in what they did. So, you know, I often say that Americans have a tendency to blame women for prohibition, when really it was male lobbyists, it was male lawyers who really got it in place. And women don't get any credit for repeal, and it was really women who championed and spearheaded the most successful repeal movement. So it's sort of the inverse of what the cliche is. The cliche is that, you know, Carrie Nation and the women suffragists / temperance advocates brought us prohibition. They certainly, I mean, there were real issues, and you're also right to point those out. Alcohol was not a joke. There were serious problems with alcohol in the United States, and there continue to be serious problems with alcohol in the United States. But, you know, the Carrie Nations did not get prohibition on the books. It was the Anti-Saloon League and the male-driven political lobby that pushed this over the edge, over the finish line.
Yeah, you mentioned women being involved and how, like, they weren't, because I did notice that, like, it was so many decades of just women being, like, going to the saloons and praying outside of them and being harassed and bullied, and then, like, their movement died, and then Carrie Nation, and she went all over Kansas and slashed all these bottles, and she was arrested 6 times, and the governor begged her to stop, and then her movement died. Yeah, but it seems like it didn't really get the legs that it needed until male lobbyists got involved.
Yeah.
So you said that women were at the forefront of ending prohibition. Can you speak more to that?
Sure. And I was really surprised. I mean, I didn't know this until I got into my research. And I think this is also one of those elements of prohibition that does not get the attention that it deserves. But, you know, prohibition, as you know, is on the books for 13 years. I think many people had come to accept it, that it was never going to go away. I mean, when has an amendment to the Constitution ever been repealed? And to this day, it's still the only one, unless I'm blanking on something. And people just, you know, sort of said, this is going to be the status quo. And it was Republican women, a woman named Pauline Sabin, who features prominently in my book, but I had read another book about her. But basically, it was conservative women for the most part, you know, often wealthy women, but they brought a respectability. They made it okay for women to say, I'm against prohibition. And what they succeeded in doing was shifting the logic by saying, if you really want, I mean, this is, I'm basically paraphrasing Pauline Sabin here. If you really want temperance, then prohibition is the last thing you should be in favor of, because prohibition has just unleashed intemperance, you know, way beyond what anyone expected or feared. So what you need is to go back to sanity and regulation and, you know, a well-administered alcohol, you know, alcohol system. And if you really want to protect kids, and if you really want to protect the home, you've got to get rid of the situation we're dealing with. So they made it okay for women to come out and say, I'm against prohibition, I'm for repeal, but that doesn't mean I'm for everyone being drunk all the time. It means I'm for, you know, I'm for normalcy. I mean, that really was, in a sense, you know, let's return to a more logical, more well-regulated, more sensible way of looking at alcohol as an issue.
So, Thank you, women.
Yes, yes.
I'm not in the mood of thanking Republican women often, but I want to just say thank you, Pauline. so, interestingly enough, I what I want to do on this podcast, and what Mia and I aim to do, is to talk about not just prohibition itself, but the legacy of prohibition. And so we do know that before prohibition, alcohol was taxed at such a rate that they had to replace the tax that they were getting from alcohol with the income tax in order to repeal alcohol to come up with the money right. somehow for the federal government to function. Right. So do you think that there would be an income tax without prohibition? Do you think that was always going to happen? But because that's something we continue to argue over to this day, and it's still so much a political divisive. It's always about taxes. Yeah. It's always about yeah. how we're going to fund the federal government.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I think Americans, you know, if there's a top five list of people in the world who are averse to taxes, I think Americans, if they're not first, they're in the top five. I mean, Americans never want to pay. They seemingly never want to pay taxes for anything. And when they do want to pay taxes, what they want to pay taxes, they want to tax you for doing the things they don't think you should be doing. So let's have cigarette taxes and alcohol taxes, gambling. You know, let's fund schools by, you know, lotteries and gambling. But God forbid we have income tax. I do think when you look at the international, you know, history and landscape of taxation, I'm not a taxation expert, but you know, I don't know that there are many modern societies that can manage fiscally without some form of income tax. And I do think that an income tax, I think the argument that we have the income tax today because of prohibition is a little overstated. Certainly there's a correlation there. And it was one of the big arguments that many repeal advocates pushed. They said, get rid of prohibition and we can get rid of the income tax. You know, we can replace the revenue. I think there were a lot of empty promises about, you know, oh, if we get rid of prohibition, then we're going to go back to, you know, some less onerous world of taxation. I don't think that was ever going to happen. But, you know, it does show you that one of the unintended consequences of prohibition, and I think there were many, and I think they're all fascinating, was that, you know, there was a price to pay fiscally in doing away with the revenue. Yeah. You know, and I think today anyone would second guess that and say, look at all the people today who push legalization of marijuana for the revenue. They say, think of the tax revenue that will come in if we legalize and tax marijuana. I think in the end, you know, again, empty promises. It somehow that money never seems to show up, and as someone who works in a school, never seems to work its way to the schools. But the arguments are there, like, okay, here's another reason. I mean, people also argue that if you did away with prohibition, it would end the Depression. Get all the breweries back in production, all the distilleries back in production, all the bars reopened. Think of the tax revenue. You know, the Depression's going to go away. Didn't remotely come true, but it was a very powerful argument for people who were looking for reasons, you know, more reasons to repeal prohibition.
So I think we should just legalize marijuana because it's fun.
I mean, people, you know. People should, yeah, I think the views of, you know, the people trying to make sort of the sideways arguments, I don't think, you know, are legit arguments about, you know, oh, if we do it, you know, here's the unseen benefit. I mean, it goes to this whole question of, look, what as a society do we think should be legal? Do we think should be regulated? At what age can you use it? What are the penalties or responses? I should say penalties. What are the responses to abusing it? You know, I was amazed reading an article a couple of weeks ago from a drug researcher. You know, the interviewer asked, you know, what's the scariest drug you've ever tried? And he said heroin. But he said heroin's not scary. It's an opioid, like any other opioid, and it's neither nor scary or less scary than any other drug. It's just another drug. So alcohol, I mean, you know, one of the arguments that people make is that, you know, alcohol is far more deadly and far more damaging than marijuana. And I think there's a lot of credence to that argument, you know. So these are all issues that we as a society are still grappling with.
I think it's also because you can just like get alcohol at any point, and like it's just so in your face always. Like I could go down the street and I can buy like 36 racks of whatever I want and drink it all day, you know, and the physical toll is terrible if you continue to do that for such a long time. Whereas like with marijuana and stuff like that, you can't find that everywhere. You have to like go through your person or, you know, things like that. So yeah, I think that alcohol technically would be way more dangerous than a lot of these other things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of these questions that comes up a lot because people say, oh, prohibition and marijuana, it's all the same thing. It's like, no, it's not, because and it has nothing to do with the relative danger or merits of the substance. It has to do with the place they have in society. And Mia, you're right. I mean, alcohol is normal. You know, it's much more commonplace. It's you know, advertised. It's run by a multi-billion dollar, trillion dollar conglomerates. Mm-hmm. You know, it's marketed. It's widely available. It's something that's, you know, just part of society. Marijuana is not seen in the same light. It's not something that's, you know, you walk down to the corner store and buy.
Yeah, like I feel like sometimes in like in social, not like social media, but in like television shows and movies, it's kind of like glamorous to have that martini or, you know, with the olives and, you know, or the onions in it. And then when you think of like marijuana, how it's perceived is more of like hippies and, you know, people who don't shower or something like that. You know, it's like a very more... I don't know.
Dirty.
Yeah, it's like a dirtier type thing, which is, that's so funny because alcohol can really ruin someone's whole entire being.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you think about prohibition and you think about the arguments towards it, and that it makes sense if you think about how it plagued people and how it really like ruined families and ruined lives. And especially, and I want to, so the, every episode we do a cocktail with the subject. And the last episode we did the Sazerac with just the history of the cocktail, because the origin stories of cocktails kind of come into play with the fantastical bartender driven stories. Who had the first cocktail? You know, that's what we did. So we chose the French 75 for this one, honestly, because we both like it. We both had, we experimented last night with some recipes and had a couple. And I want to ask why, I mean, it's not a shock to me as we talk about, you know, weed being so accessible, even though it's still like kind of technically illegal, even though, by the way, I can go up the street and buy a joint. I don't know if all you knew that in Beacon, you can go buy a joint up here. So PSA for anyone that's coming up to Beacon. But the access that people had to like barrels of alcohol at a time when it was illegal federally, how was that even possible to import gin like that?
Well, okay. A lot of it wasn't imported, was the, you know, I mean, you've heard the term the real McCoy. You know, so that term, legend has it, was because there was a bootlegger named McCoy who was known for getting you the real stuff. Mm-hmm. And most of this, I mean, this is what I found in my research, that the, you know, 90, I can't remember if it was 95, 97, 93, but, you know, high 90% of any liquor that you bought in New York City was not what it was labeled to be. It was tainted. It means it was poisoned, basically. And this is why gin, I mean, I saw that you had highlighted the French 75, and I think it's interesting. I mean, I may be getting way too conceptual here, but like on one hand, gin is the liquor of prohibition. And why? Because you could just take industrial alcohol and add glycerin and flavoring and call it gin and put it in a bottle. And there you had it, and it was horrible. I mean, it was literally deadly at some times. Champagne, on the other hand, is a lot harder to fake. And you certainly, I mean, I certainly came across stories where people were saying like, yeah, this is not champagne. That's very clear.
Yeah.
If you wanted to get your hands on French champagne, you know, French wine, you know, European liquors or wines, You could, but it wasn't easy. And it was much, much easier for bootleggers to get either doctored and improvised, for lack of a better word, product into people's hands and glasses, or they diverted medicinal liquor. I mean, that was also a big thing that, if you bought, you could get a prescription for whiskey. I mean, again, we'll talk about parallels to marijuana. I mean, I don't think the famous prescription was you would get a prescription. If you had influenza, you would get a prescription for whiskey and go to your pharmacist and they'd say, oh yeah, this is just the treatment you need for influenza. Wow. The same way.
You need whiskey, sir.
Yes, you need whiskey. But everyone knew that if you wanted, real whiskey and didn't want to worry about poisoning yourself, your only safe place to get it was a pharmacy. They didn't sell gin. But you look at the prescriptions today that are doled out for medical marijuana, and I bet a lot of them have as much merit as the prescription for whiskey during prohibition.
I absolutely can back that up. When I lived in California, I needed a medical marijuana card in order to feel really cool about buying weed. And I was like, my hip hurts. The guy was like, you clearly need a medical marijuana card. It was so easy to get one. Yeah. It was this like janky doctor in like some rundown office. It was so sketchy. I went there. I did it. I was 20 years old. I felt really cool.
And it's amazing. The number, last time I was in California, I was amazed to see the dispensaries everywhere. The parallel is during Prohibition in New York State, the number of pharmacies tripled. I wonder why.
Yeah. Oh, that's crazy. I actually read about George Remus was his name.
Yep.
And he he was a lawyer. So Mia, I don't know if you know about George Remus.
No.
He was a lawyer that read about, he spent all this time reading basically trying to find loopholes through the prohibition laws. And he decided that if he paid off enough people, he could get permits to basically become his own supplier to the pharmacies that he owned.
And then he
sold like illegal stuff and it just like came back around and he was this just like kingpin of like prohibition era bootlegging. That was just, it was like, I marvel at it. Like what a G, man. Yeah. Like that guy just like figured it out. So was this happening? And like, I know we hear of these stories, but was this happening just basically all over New York? Just people finding loopholes in prohibition laws?
Sure. I mean, it's the loopholes were glaring and obvious, I mean, starting with on the federal level, it was okay. It was illegal to manufacture, transport, or sell. It was not illegal to possess. So let's just start with that giant loophole. And the problem with that right off the bat was that, the wealthier you were, and this goes right to the heart of the class element of prohibition, the wealthier you were, the easier it was to get your hands on whatever you wanted. And there was no penalty for possession. So if you had a giant wine collection, a giant wine cellar, or, a huge stockpile of liquor, or the real case examples, if you were one of the elite private clubs in New York City, the Yale Club, all the gentlemen's clubs, they could serve because they weren't charging ostensibly. So they weren't selling and it wasn't a crime to possess. So, you were basically, untouchable. The people who got busted. It was the rich win. And that was obvious to everyone. And who's getting busted? The people who are selling it, the people who are transporting it. So you've got a car full of whiskey bottles, you're going to go to jail. You're the bartender who gets caught in the raid. You're going to go to jail. But the owner can say, I didn't know my bartender was selling alcohol.
Mm.
So, then you get the state level loopholes, weird inconsistencies about what percentage of what was legal and not legal. So it was not a well crafted law from the enforcement side. And that just, you know, that just exacerbated the problems.
Prohibition just feels like one of those things that people like spent so long. It's like you get to the Super Bowl. It's like they spend so long like gearing up for this big fight and then they win and they're like, now what? Like no one, it feels like no one really knew what to do with it.
Right.
And
right.
No one enforced it. And like there, but there were towns that it worked and they felt like a better way of life happened. And then you have places like New York City, it seems that no one enforced it.
And no one just, I mean, enforcement became, you're absolutely right. I mean, here was a campaign that took, you know, nearly 20 years. And then when it finally got on the books, it was like there was no plan. Or the plan was so, you know, so half-assed, sorry for being so technical, but so half-assed, no. It just, you know, it was unenforceable. So you're asking, you know, New York City policemen to enforce prohibition. They're not interested. They don't care. Everyone knows that the NYPD, you know, at that point, and to some degree now, is still overwhelmingly Irish. But in terms of the overwhelmingly Irish police force of the 1920s, they didn't want to be raiding their, you know, their uncle's bar.
Yeah.
So they were pissed off to be pulled into this. Then you had these prohibition agents who were political appointees. I mean, talk about, you know, a big policy mistake. So political appointee, I can appoint as a politician, I could be dead set against prohibition, but I can appoint prohibition agents. So I can dole these jobs out to whoever I want to. And it's a government job. You know, you get a government job, a gun, yeah, and a badge. And I've found lots and lots of cases of, I mean, the corruption in enforcement was notorious. And anyone should have seen that coming.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to happen. I mean, you start making things illegal, people are going to find a way to get it.
Yeah.
Which I got to ask. So the French 75 cocktail that we're covering, I mean, it's easy to fake and make gin, but the champagne, was this like a hoity-toity rich person access to champagne drink? Is that how this became popular?
I'll confess, I don't know a whole lot about the history of the specific cocktail in terms of the French 75. My understanding was it came out of World War I. I mean, the reference is obviously to the 75-millimeter cannon.
Yeah.
And, you know, actually, I don't know if it was earlier than World War I, but, you know, it was a French drink, not the product of prohibition in the United States. I don't see a lot of references to people drinking it during prohibition. You do see lots of references to people coming up with gin cocktails of lots of different varieties. But, you know, speakeasies were, the whole world of speakeasies, you know, high profit, short lifespan. You probably wouldn't want to mix a very expensive and hard to obtain champagne with rot gut bathtub gin.
Yeah.
It doesn't make a lot of sense.
I feel like when I was looking into the whole French 75 thing, it was saying also that people were using tonic water to substitute for the champagne. And so that's where like the Tom Collins came in. And that was like the more middle class version of the French 75, because they couldn't obtain the champagne, so they just did like tonic water instead.
Yeah.
And just kept all the other same ingredients, and that was their like version of a French 75. So I feel like with the champagne, I definitely think like what you're saying, Alexa, I think it does have to kind of go hand in hand with wealth too, unless you just, you know, happen to come across it and you're like, let's celebrate the fact that we even have this bottle in front of us. Ding! You know?
Yeah. I mean, I did come, you know, in the nightclubs. I was just looking back through my book a few minutes before we got on air. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of conspicuous consumption in the 20s. And you certainly, if you had the means to do so, you certainly wanted to show off publicly, if possible, that you could afford champagne and you were drinking it. There's all sorts of stuff about it. I mean, Texas Guinan, who was one of the more well-known New York nightclub hostesses, and people talk about going to Texas Guy and his nightclub and spending, you know, thousands of dollars and knowing the champagne was fake. But, you know, but still, like, hey, we had a hell of a, I mean, that was the exact line from one guy. I spent, I can't remember the exact dollar amount, but, and we had a hell of a time. So, you know, that was part of the roaring 20s. You wanted to show that you could afford the good stuff. And even if the good stuff was fake, you know, it's like having a fake Louis Vuitton bag today, I guess. I mean, yeah. You still want to show off that you got your Louis Vuitton.
Logo. You yeah. See love this? Logo. $5.
So we talked about now some of the upper class ways people celebrated, you know, their newfound non-taxed alcohol they got to get a hold of. What about, so this really did though affect the immigrant population. It affected the lower income class. It affected, and talk about a caste system. I mean, I feel like this really truly brought it out, and they were exploited in such a way where it's like, see alcohol, look at what it does to them. This is why we shouldn't have it, because they can just give themselves a better life without alcohol. I feel like they were not only the scapegoats, but they were also like the example of what people were trying to say like could happen to you. It just seems like the immigrant population was not only being told their way of life wasn't important, but it was also like their way of life was evil.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, what's the difference between temperance and prohibition? Temperance is when you decide you're going to stop drinking, and prohibition is when you decide someone else is going to stop drinking. Mm-hmm. And in prohibition, you know, I mean, there were plenty of well-documented cases of people who were strong supporters of prohibition who had no intention of giving up drinking themselves. They wanted to stop the blacks and the Italians and the Irish and the Eastern Europeans and, you know, whoever mm-hmm. from drinking, because, you know, drunk Italians, drunk blacks, drunk Eastern Europeans, drunk Jews. I mean, they were just seen as this, you know, threat to, you know, the ideal of America.
And I just think that's so silly when everyone is an immigrant, you know, like, especially closer to those times, like, come on, like, let's get real. Stop being such an asshole and just let people be. I mean, even now today, but anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to chime in on that,
No, you're completely right. I think one of the questions I had for you is like, this certainly isn't the first time, but it's this whole argument of, can you legislate morality? Right. You know, it was the whole bungle of it was that you can't, like, there's no, you can't write into a law about how to be a better person. Mm-hmm. Right. And trying to fuse the two, I think, was honestly, if you look back in hindsight, the biggest mistake, because making something illegal only makes people want it more. Mm-hmm. And they'll find more and more creative ways to get it, and they won't feel like it's, you break the law once, I mean, what's the harm in breaking it more? And then more and more people break the law, and then who's going to,
it's riots, like, and stuff, because no one wants to listen. And
well, you have brutal killings and massacres, and is that like what the breaking point was for prohibition ending? It's just like, look around us. It's a mess.
Yeah. I mean, the breaking point, I mean, I you should really think of it as a breaking point. I mean, it was an accumulation of things. One was the Depression, and people were like, this is insane. You know, we're all obsessed with policing alcohol, and we're in financial ruin as a country. Mm-hmm. And we need to be thinking about that. So just people were more concerned about, you know, food than alcohol. The other was the enforcement had gotten so, I mean, the prisons were full, the courts were full. You know, if you got arrested on a prohibition charge, it might be 2 years before your case came up for trial because there was such a backlog. The corruption was huge. And then, you know, organized crime. I mean, I do think the organized crime thing gets overplayed a little bit, but it's clear that, you know, there was violence, there was, you know, graft, there was, things had gotten out of control. And people could just look and say, this is not working. And even people, I think what was part of the whole turning point was that when people who had been supporters of prohibition said, you know, I've seen enough and I can't support this any longer. When you asked earlier, can you legislate morality? I mean, you can't tell people how to live their lives, but you can certainly regulate. And prohibition was too black and white, you know, and what people said, like, okay, so no one wants children drinking. I mean, that's not a good idea in general. You were better served by a bartender who said, I'm not going to serve a child. You know, I'm trying to run a respectable establishment. Right. I serve adults. You know, I have no interest in serving children. Take away the saloon and suddenly, you know, kids are drinking on the street. Mm-hmm. There's no one watching the shop.
Right.
Take the corruption out, you know, put the police back on, get the temptation of the money away from them and the corruption will go away. The problem was that, you know, any prohibition enforcement agent or police officer walked into a situation could be confronted. And this happened over and over again, confronted by someone saying, look, I'm going to give you $5,000 to turn around and walk out the door.
I would have been such a corrupt cop. I absolutely would have taken that money. I would have been just rolling in my bills with a police badge.
Oh, there's a butterfly. Mm.
Just kidding. I was a woman. I wasn't allowed to do anything.
oh my gosh.
I would have been outside praying and getting soaked in hoses. I think what's interesting to me, and I think this is where I get to, like, now modern day. So the three-tier system of alcohol distribution is always funny, and it is state by state, it seems, because I grew up in Utah where the beer being served can't be over 3.2%. And if you wanted to go to a bar or a restaurant that served beer over 3.2%, it had to be a private club in which you paid a membership. And so for people to get around this, you would have to pay a $10 like membership when you sat down, and then they could serve you beer. Like, there's obviously loopholes in Utah's version of this, like, consistently prohibition era law. But the liquor that is sold has to be sold at a state sanctioned liquor store. And even beer that's over 3.2% has to be sold at a state sanctioned liquor store. And that still works today. So I guess my question for you, Michael, is the aftermath of prohibition, it seemed to have affected states differently. What in particular did New York keep from prohibition that is sort of this like invisible legacy of prohibition that we don't really think about today because we're just so in it, you know, we're like just in it all the time and we don't really see the linkage.
Yeah, so it's a great question. I mean, I wouldn't frame it as what did New York keep, but it's like, what did New York, how did it evolve? And, you know, some of it evolved very quickly and some of it is only recently, you know, things that, I mean, some of it's still in place. I mean, I laughed, I could not believe this when I came across it, but when prohibition was first repealed in New York, the rule was you could not serve drinks to anyone standing.
Okay.
And, you know,
it that's kind of like right now, though, if you think about it, you can't get a drink right now in New York or anywhere if you're not sitting at a table because you have to order food.
Right. I mean, it's really funny when you think of, you know, people's ideas of like, okay, I know, you know, whether it's today, like you have to buy a bag of potato chips to go with your whiskey because that'll stop you from abusing alcohol.
So silly.
And the thing about standing, you know, the thing about standing was it was like, okay, we don't want to go back to the old time saloon where men stood at the bar. Now, no one was going to go back to the old time saloon. You'd just been through a 14-year reinvention of people's drinking habits. And one of the things that was very clear is that women were now going to be, you know, a central part of this world, even though they had not been, you know, a big part of the saloon world. So, so the idea was, you know, I guess to keep it less scary now that women were there, you know, have everyone seated at tables. I don't know how long that lasted, but that went out, you know, soon enough. But then the things, you know, New York still had, until quite recently that you couldn't, you know, the liquor stores couldn't be open on Sundays. This whole thing now about, you know, buying food with your outdoor drinks is, you know, again, someone thinking, okay, how do we mitigate this? The fact that, that, you know, liquor cannot be sold in grocery stores and wine cannot be sold in grocery stores, you know, is a peculiar New York twist. I mean, I think it's very fun and quaint to travel, you know, these wonderful United States and go from state to state and saying, now, what can you do here? Where can you buy this here? Okay, you have to go to a state-run shop here. And if the beer is more than 3.2%, you have to buy it in this place. And, you know, it's just kind of funny to see how this is still part of our culture. But, you know, the whole thing about you had to have, this was a couple of years ago, but they opened the Whole Foods in Columbus Circle in the huge Time Warner Center. And, you know, they wanted to have a liquor store or a wine store as part of the store. But the law was that any wine store had to have a separate entrance to the street. And you obviously can't do that in a basement. So they couldn't. Mm-mm. I mean, it's just stupid. You know, what does that serve? You can't buy wine underground. I mean, what does that help? But it just shows you it's another case of how so many, there's so much fear in the way these laws are engineered. I mean, even New York, it's been very interesting to me to see the growth of distilleries in New York in the last 10 years, which was due to finally, you know, changing some of the laws and encouraging, you know, the rule is it has to be New York state grown stuff that they're distilling, and then it's okay. And then you're in a new category and you can do your distilling and sell directly to the public. Otherwise you can't do that. And also the, you know, the return of small scale brewing, you know, these were all things that took a long time, 50 years, 60 years, 70 years after Prohibition. So my point is simply that the laws are still evolving and we seem to tweak them to the particular circumstances. It's like, oh, okay, we've got a pandemic now. How are we going to, what do we need to do with our liquor laws to, you know, address the drinking habits of pandemic drinkers?
It's funny because at the beginning of the pandemic when restaurants were shut down, but they allowed you to take liquor to go, Beacon was bumping. Like, I would walk around and I was like, really? Like, no one's wearing masks. Everyone's drinking these cocktails. It was like New Orleans, which was, don't get me wrong, I didn't hate it. It was just, I felt unsafe going outside, like walking my dog. But do you see a parallel? Do you think that the laws that are, I mean, this is just clearly hypothetical. I know you're not a fan of hypotheticals, but do you think that the laws that we're enacting now to sort of deal with this pandemic, do you think that they might stick the same way that some Prohibition era laws kind of like hung around and were really hard to leap over and combat?
I think that there are going to be things about this. I mean, I live on the Lower East Side, and believe me, you know, it was party central all summer. And I, frankly, even though I wasn't, you know, I'm like, look, I'm drinking at home on my balcony. I'm not standing in the middle of Orchard Street among the hordes, you know, and getting coronavirus and dying for a Negroni. I mean, I might die for a good Negroni, but I'm not going to.
There you go. I was going to ask, but is this a great Negroni or just a so-so Negroni? What kind of Negroni are we talking here?
But I think it will be really interesting to see as this, you know, hopefully starts to decline and diminish, what the restaurant lobby is going to push to hold on to. And, you know, whether it's a recovery, you know, let's think back to Prohibition. Well, if we reopen the bars and the breweries and the distillers, all the jobs will come back and the Depression will end. Well, if we continue to let people to buy drinks to go and drink on the street, that will help the, you know, economy get back in shape. I mean, there's a logic to it.
Yeah.
I do think there are going to be some very serious discussions about, you know, where all of this goes from here. I mean, you see a lot of food and restaurant writers writing about, you know, the positives of outdoor dining and, you know, is this now going to become a permanent part of our food landscape or dining landscape. And, you know, yeah, it's just a sign of everyone always has to ask, like, okay, is it okay to drink outside? You know, I mean, the New Orleans, when you mentioned it was like New Orleans, yeah, I was thinking, wow, New Orleans has finally come. If it's okay for them to walk around with drinks, is it really so bad for New Yorkers? You know, but we'll see. You know, you never know. But I do think it'll be part of the debate. Well, I think it also shows, I mean, you know, to bring it back to Prohibition, which I always do, it's like people want bars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if, you know, people said, well, what if we just close bars and people can drink at home? I mean, people, that's not enough for people. They don't want to necessarily drink at home because it's the social experience of the bar and the community place. I mean, that, you know, when we talk about the impact of Prohibition on the ethnic neighborhood, the ethnic community, I mean, these saloons, these bars were centers of, they were living rooms, they were clubs, they were where people saw each other, they were where, you know, you found out about jobs, they were, you could pick up your mail, you could get a loan from the bar owner for a funeral. You know, they served a legitimate social purpose. And I think that's one thing that's been constant, you know, for 100 years now, which is that, you know, in a time of crisis, people are, they turn to alcohol. I mean, it's, you know, everyone knows alcohol sales have been booming in the last year and a half, but they also really hold on to the notion that they want a place to go drink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they want to drink with their friends.
Mm-hmm. We miss it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I miss it. I mean, it's a big part of social life.
Yeah. I miss just like going, you know what I miss, which is not necessarily going with friends. I miss just walking up to a bar by myself, sitting down at the bar, ordering a pint of beer and like chatting with the bartender. It's this like simple thing I took for granted for so many years. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I just want to do it without wearing a mask, without sitting behind a shield, without them being like, okay, here's your beer, bye. And like them running away because if you linger too long, it feels unsafe. It's just, it really sucks right now. And I have to say, like, probably during Prohibition, it really sucked then too for people that really utilized the bar as a social scene and kind of maybe the only place they could get out of their tiny house.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you think of the notion of sacrifice. I mean, I when we talked yesterday, I brought up World War I a little bit. And, you know, people were willing to sacrifice for a war.
Yeah.
And I do think to some extent, some people are willing to sacrifice for the sake of public health in a pandemic. But in Prohibition, you know, if you were like a, you know, Italian or Black or Irish, you know, working class drinker, you're like, who am I sacrificing for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who am I giving alcohol up? Why do I have to do this? Who is this benefiting?
Yeah. And it really, like, understandably so, people were not only offended by the notion of giving up their culture, but being used as like, well, look at them. Look at this dirty German. Like, oh, the Huns. Yeah. It was just like, I look at the propaganda back then and it makes me sick to my stomach.
Yeah,
but it's not so far away from the propaganda that we use now. It's just a little more finely tuned.
Yeah.
A little less exaggerated. There's so much nuance to we've learned so much from the propaganda machine of Prohibition and during these like earlier war times that we've just learned how to finely tune it to the exact demographic that needs to hear it.
Right.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Keep it to an hour with you. I know you have a lot going on. Being, you know, we're preparing for an entirely new semester of students and work to be done. Is that accurate? You're actually preparing for a whole new, great. I didn't lie to myself.
The new semester starts on Monday. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you get back to trying to teach the young children of today how to be, they're going to save us all. Thank God for them. But thank you so much for your time today. We really, really appreciate it. You are so smart and obviously an expert in your field. Mm-hmm. So if we ever do another series on Prohibition, we'd love to have you back. If you'd love to be back.
I would love to be back. This was fun. Thank you both for the opportunity.
Absolutely.
And, thank you.
Glad to talk to you.
All right, folks, that's our episode. Thank you so much to Michael Lerner for joining us. Thank you to you, our listeners.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for our next episode.
Woo!
I'm your host, Alexa Wilkinson.
And I am your co-host, Mia Fiorito.
And this is
Drink History.
Drink History is produced by me, Alex Wilkinson, and our theme song is by Blue Topaz. Episodes will be released every Wednesday and distributed by Anchor. Visit drinkhistorypodcast.com for more info and help us out by sharing and rating where all podcasts are available. And feel free to leave a voicemail to let us know how you feel about the show. Cheers!